From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Alfred Nobel and Joseph Pulitzer are men best remembered for the prizes that bear their names rather than the lives they led. James McGrath Morris attempts to rectify half that situation with his brilliant new biography, Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print, and Power. James McGrath Morris is also the author of The Rose Man of Sing Sing, A True Tale of Life, Murder, and Redemption, which was selected as a Washington Post Best Book of the Year for 2004. And his work has appeared in The Washington Post and The New York Observer and The Baltimore Sun. James McGrath Morris, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
In your book, you say that Pulitzer was to publishing what Carnegie was to steel and Vanderbilt to transportation and Rockefeller to oil, etc., and that Pulitzer transformed newspapers into power and created mass media.
That's very true, and one of the interesting things for me about exploring him is when I started this project a mere 6 years ago, and I would tell people I was working on Joseph Pulitzer, their eyes would light up with recognition about his name because of the prize, but they didn't know much about him. And he really is one of the undiscovered giants of the 19th century whose work at that time, now 100 and some years ago, still touches us today. Essentially, what Pulitzer did in his life was create what we now think of as the modern mass media. Now, when I say this, he's not alone. There are other people like him who were working at that time, but if you want to compare it to Picasso and Cubism, Pulitzer was the Picasso of journalism in the sense that he was the leading proponent that changed journalism from a very boring media to an exciting media and one consumed by the masses.
Well, what were newspapers like before Pulitzer?
Well, frankly, they were pretty boring. And they were also catered only to one group, and that was the group who had enough money to spend what may seem like nothing today, but several cents for a newspaper. They were short. The typography was all the same, and the news was not written in the way that we're used to today. You might have a letter from London, which would appear almost every day with the same headline. You'd have to read to the bottom of the story to find out that some war was over somewhere in Europe. And with the advent of Pulitzer and the creation of independent journalism, this all changed. It all became very, very different.
Well, so how did this penniless Hungarian Jew, you know, rise to power in American journalism?
Well, his tale is not much different than many of the other 19th century giants. He came to the United States as a mercenary soldier to serve in the final war of our Civil War, final year of our Civil War. And then he went to St. Louis, and the reason he went to St. Louis is he spoke only German. And just like a Latino coming to the United States would probably choose to live in an area where there are other Spanish speakers, St. Louis was virtually a German city with five or six German papers published daily, and a place for a young man like that to find opportunity. And he rose up in the hurly-burly world of immigrant politics under the leadership of a man named Carl Schurz. And politics and journalism at this time were really two sides of the same coin. So unemployed politicians became editors, and successful editors became elected politicians. So Pulitzer actually began his life as a politician, getting elected to the state legislature in Missouri and beginning to think this is the path he would take.
So he thought politics were his future.
Yes, and you know, he kept an interest in politics in a consuming way. We forget that, but politics in the 19th century was a participatory sport. You went out for torchlight parades, you followed it with excitement. Today it's sort of in the background of our lives, and up until the very last year of his life, Pulitzer followed politics the way sports fans follow their teams. He knew every statistic, he knew every election result, and was deeply involved. So he never stopped being a politician, although a loss in his attempt to remain an elected politician is what led him into a career as a newspaper publisher.
Well, he was involved in newspapers and politics simultaneously. I mean, he was holding office and also...
He did something that would be frowned on deeply at this point. He was the Capitol correspondent in Jefferson City, Missouri, while serving as an elected official there. And yes, the coverage of his work was very complimentary.
And did he have a byline, or did he say me, or did he say...
No, bylines didn't really exist at that point, but once you do this kind of research, you begin to be able to recognize somebody's style, or you know that they're on a particular beat, so that you know his work. But he would write about himself in the third person. He covered his own election speech in the third person. So it was great fun doing that kind of research.
Well, you know, we think of Joseph Pulitzer is a very civilized individual and a high-class publisher, but he actually shot a guy?
Oh, yeah, that's a terrific story. When he was elected legislator in Jefferson City, he took off against a famous and notorious lobbyist from St. Louis. These were very, very corrupt times. This man, Augustine, had been in charge of digging the well at the new state insane asylum that was being built, actually a county insane asylum. And he was being paid by the foot, and after going several hundreds of feet, he still hadn't struck water. In fact, it was the second deepest well on the globe. And this was typical of the kind of government corruption that existed back then. And Pulitzer tried to bring an end to it when he was a legislator, enraging this man. And they met in a hotel in Jefferson City, and one of them called the other a pup, which may seem like a harmless word.
You're kidding, a pup?
Yeah, but when you start researching, you know, life was different back then. When you start researching 19th century, what you discover is that that's a term of engagement for a duel. So Pulitzer went back to his hotel room, got his pistol, which apparently most legislators had. I don't know what that says about constituent relations, but anyway, came back to the hotel, and they got back at it, and Pulitzer took two shots, not very good aim, and only managed to graze Augustine's leg. Augustine overpowered him with a set of brass knuckles, which he had, and that was that.
Now, eventually, maybe I shouldn't give away any part of your story, but eventually this guy died of gunshot wounds, self-inflicted, right?
He did, and it's an interesting tale for me, because, you know, when you spend several years trying to get a sense of the person you're living with, you're looking for clues. And the man you're speaking about does commit suicide with a gun. And other newspapers in St. Louis at that point treat it in a very sensationalistic fashion. And Pulitzer, who has his own newspaper, restrains his coverage. And it's the first clue that I began to get that this man, who was one of the giants of that time and often cruelly portrayed, actually had a very soft side. He never, in the end, kicked anyone when they were down, and that was the first tip-off I got of that.
So even though he hated the guy and tried to shoot him himself, when he committed suicide, he soft-pedaled it in his paper.
Yes, and when he gets onto the bigger stage in New York, running the most powerful newspaper in the world, in fact, he does this again and again with some of his enemies. When his enemies are down and his editors say, oh, we can really go after them now, Pulitzer orders restraint.
Well, this book, by the way, if you're just joining us, we're talking with James McGrath Morris, and his book is called Pulitzer, The Man and His Beard. Oh, no, I'm sorry, that's not what it's called. It's called A Life in Politics, Print and Power. When he gets to New York, he was sort of a champion of the common man. It feels like a movie, this book, by the way, or a long miniseries or something. But so he was a champion of the common man originally.
He was, but it's a radical step, because you see the newspapers that existed when Pulitzer came to New York, and you have to understand New York was the capital of newspapers at that point. They all were on one short block downtown. And what Pulitzer had been doing in St. Louis before he came to New York was very much like a Broadway producer trying out his play in the hinterlands before bringing them to the stage in New York. So now he comes to New York in 1883, buys a bankrupt newspaper, and instead of imitating all the other newspapers, he sees this vast wave of immigrants coming to New York, the disenfranchised, the poor, that are living in the Lower East Side. Instead of viewing them as a threat, he sees them as a potential audience. So he admonishes his reporters to write about this group of people and to write about it in a fashion that's understandable, with short, punchy sentences, and most particularly to look for the story. Here's a man who's a Dickens fan, and he sees in the urban drama of that time that really all of the stuff we have are stories. Murders are stories. Deaths are stories. Police beatings, they're stories. So his tennis reporters off to do this, and by doing that, he really elevated and dignified this group of people because they were reading the paper to learn English. They were learning about their own lives. And by seeing their lives in print, it has the same power. If you want to give an example of something that Pulitzer gave us that's still here today, go into anybody's kitchen and look on the refrigerator. You'll find clippings from newspapers about their children's accomplishments. It's not that the children's accomplishments weren't worthy of anything before it was in paper, but by being put into type, it gives it a kind of dignity, a kind of importance. And in a short way, that's exactly what Pulitzer was doing for these disenfranchised masses, who in turn were giving him their pennies to buy the paper, because it was only a penny, and creating his vast fortune.
So he looked at the masses as a penny a pocket.
He did, but there are two things going on. One, what he's doing is creating news as a commodity, something that we buy for entertainment, buy for information. His paper on Sunday was as thick as a telephone book, and it had things like sheet music so the family could play songs from it, dress patterns, serializations of novels, even color cartoons, comics that we now take for granted. They first appeared in the New York World. So he supplied, and this is the world before internet, before radio, he supplied a complete entertainment package to this group for very little money, took their money to make a fortune, but it wasn't the money he was interested in. He saw journalism as, you know, going back to his roots as a politician, as a means of power. And the power he wanted to exercise was for progressive reform, for things that we now take for granted. But in his time, you know, something as radical as the five-hour day was a you know, very progressive and remarkable concept. And those are the kinds of causes he took up.
Although he famously locked horns with progressive President Theodore Roosevelt.
Very much so. It's one of those, you know, when you're writing nonfiction, you can't make up a story, so you get really excited when a story occurs. Roosevelt and Pulitzer, if they'd gotten together, probably agreed on 9 out of 10 reforms, but their egos could never get them together on anything. And Pulitzer used humor in his editorials quite regularly, and that was a deadly sin because he made fun of Teddy Roosevelt, and Roosevelt never forgot that kind of thing. So they had a battle for about 25 years over almost everything, and eventually Roosevelt, in his last year in office, decides to take revenge on Pulitzer and tries to use the prosecutorial might of the federal government to put Pulitzer in jail or in prison for the rest of his life. And that was sort of one of the epic battles of the end of their life, at least Pulitzer's life.
Well, it's a fascinating story. And what was the final straw between them that made Roosevelt want to imprison him? I mean, on what grounds did he try to imprison him?
The final straw for Roosevelt, again, you know, these are both very egocentric men. The final straw for Roosevelt was that Pulitzer's paper suggested that the Panama Canal might have involved some corruption.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, you know, the Panama Canal was Roosevelt's greatest achievement.
And was there a great deal of corruption in
there? Well, the best suggestion is that we had to pay off a number of French stockholders who owned the equipment and the land that was in the Panama zone. You remember, there was no Panama. Roosevelt fostered a revolution where Panama broke away from Colombia and then signed a deal with us. And it's likely that a lot of that money the federal government appropriated went to some people in France that it's not a bribe, and it may not have necessarily been illegal, but it wouldn't, as we would say in the ethical world, pass the smell test.
We're speaking with James McGrath Morris, and his book is called Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print and Power. And it's an amazing book. And how did you go about, you know, collecting all this information and getting, I mean, you got a lot of details from a long time ago. How did you do it?
Well, I started off life as a reporter, so I love details. And I also had a very long deadline. I worked on this for 5 years. But I was extremely fortunate in some of my detective work. Pulitzer was one of 9 children, only 2 of which lived to adulthood. And one of them was his brother Albert, who came to the United States also, created a newspaper in New York, which is the newspaper that William Randolph Hearst will eventually buy to compete against Pulitzer. So if you want some sibling rivalry, there it is. And I knew that before his death, he had written a memoir. His brother Albert committed suicide in 1909, and the son went to Vienna, where the father had died, and announced to the world that he'd published this memoir, but it never appeared. Well, I was lucky. I found one of the descendants, his granddaughter, who was living in Paris, under a different name, because she was a religious sculptress, and she found if she said, "My name is Muriel Pulitzer," the French would say, "Ah, are you related to the famous Pulitzers?" And she wanted to make it on her own hook, so she took her mother's maiden name. So she disappeared under the radar. And the long and short of it is I went to Paris, met with her, and she did indeed have the typed manuscript from a century ago. So that allowed me to be able to really play out the sibling rivalry between them to portray his youth more accurately. And that is an example of the kind of very lucky finds I had in the course of my research.
Well, you mentioned Hearst, and those of us who have seen Citizen Kane, which would be everybody.
Yes.
It's that famous scene where Kane steals his opponent's newspaper staff. Did anything like that actually occur?
Yes, actually, that's one of the few parts of the movie that's quite true. When Hearst is an imitator, and by his own admission, he admired Pulitzer's journalism. He didn't like Pulitzer, but he liked and admired what he did. So when he came to New York, he was outdoing Pulitzer. But there's a big difference between the two. Hearst had this vast inheritance, and Pulitzer's money had been self-made. So Hearst was perfectly content to fund his newspaper from his checkbook for years at a loss, whereas for Pulitzer, a loss would mean a serious loss. And so he engaged in checkbook hiring. He, at one point, hired the entire Sunday staff of Pulitzer's paper. I should even add, he had offices in Pulitzer's building, so it wasn't too hard. He'd bring them down to his office and say, "Do you want to come and work for me?" And then Pulitzer sent his staff, sent his right-hand man to hire these guys back. So several times, the entire staff of one of the editions, like the Sunday edition, changed from one paper to the other. And several of the editors, I mean, Hearst's most famous editor, Arthur Brisbane, had been originally a Pulitzer editor and went on to work for Hearst until the end of his life. So, yes, they did engage in a lot of that.
And the comic strip that you mentioned, the famous Yellow Kid,
mm-hmm.
and then that somehow translates into the phrase that we call yellow journalism. How did that come about?
Well, you know, if you go to a library and ask to see any of these newspapers from the past, they'll sit you down in front of a microfilm reader and show you scratchy black and white versions. What folks don't realize is these papers were published in color, on color paper, and had color comics. And so the most famous of them was The Yellow Kid, and Hearst bought the artist from Pulitzer to bring him over to his paper. But Pulitzer still had the right to the name of the comic strip. So they both ended up publishing comic strips about The Yellow Kid. And so in the late 1890s, when both newspapers were considered to be extremely sensational in comparison to the more staid New York Times, they began to be referred to as the Yellow Press, or the Yellow Papers. And this was taken very seriously. I mean, there are libraries in New York who refused to display the newspapers because they thought they were unhealthy and might convince people to engage in bad activities.
They were unhealthy because they carried some of these things you were talking about,
yeah.
Murder and...
Exactly. They carried the news of the city. And the problem is that, you know, I think in part the charge of sensationalism, which at times they were guilty of, is somewhat of a class-based accusation. The staid upper class of New York who were used to their timid newspapers would say, "Oh, this is all sensationalistic prattle in these papers." But if you went down to the Lower East Side and had a drink in a black and tan, which is what those bars were called, or you went into a tenement house and sat down to listen to what the conversation was at dinner, they would be talking about the kinds of news that the world covered. And that's that relationship that I think is so important that existed back then that led to these sensationalistic charges. Now, there is a reason they also are, in a sense, sensationalistic. They didn't necessarily make up stuff. I mean, there was a dead body, a murdered corpse, but the way they wrote about it very often invoked adjectives and diagrams and all kinds of things. So we shouldn't think that they made up lock, stock, and barrel stories, but they tended to treat them with a lot of drama and storytelling techniques.
You mentioned in the book when somebody committed suicide that all the papers made sure to discuss the brain matter. That
oh, yeah. I mean, this is the point about libraries feeling uncomfortable that this stuff could be read, particularly by women and particularly by young people. One of my favorite stories about this is actually kind of a reverse of all of this. Pulitzer was very prudish. He had a Victorian sense. So his newspaper could cover rape and murder, but direct conversation about sex was strictly forbidden. And now he's late in life, and he's gone blind, so he has a staff that reads him the newspaper. And one day, one of the readers was reading a story about a very famous New York socialite woman who was displaying her nursery to the reporter, and the reporter was describing how the nursery was being decorated. Well, Pulitzer went absolutely nuts over this. If there's a nursery, that means the woman must be pregnant. If she's pregnant, that means she must have had sex. And many of the upper-class women, when they were pregnant, didn't go out for that very reason. They didn't show themselves to the public. So Pulitzer wires back to New York instructions that the reporter be fired. His editor finds out who the reporter is, and it turns out to be a woman named Zona Gale. And she is let go. And the great delicious irony is about 8 years or 7 years after Pulitzer's death, she's one of the first women to win a Pulitzer Prize.
That's
so I like to think of it as the day that Pulitzer fired a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter.
So you mentioned his blindness. How did that come about?
Well, it's one of the great arcs of the story of this man's life. In 1888 or so, when he was at the height of his power, and this was running this newspaper that was so powerful and so widely circulated that today the New York Times would have to increase its circulation by 300 to 500% to match that kind of power. So here he is endorsing presidents. You know, his opinion is sought by everybody, and he's publishing this newspaper. And he suffers from detached retinas and begins to go blind. Now, this is a medical problem that today can be solved. In fact, my wife accuses me of over-identification with my subject. When I finished the book, I suffered exactly that. But I was lucky. I was able to get to the hospital within time, and my eyesight was saved. But that was not available for Pulitzer.
Wow.
So slowly he descends into this world of darkness. It takes a number of years. And it's combined with this terrific generalized anxiety he has that leads him to become the Howard Hughes of the 19th century, going from one nation to another in one of the most luxurious yachts, surrounded in a cocoon of silence because sound is terrifying to him, and served hand and foot by 17 or 18 men who read to him and play the piano for him and handle his correspondence. Because his correspondence was prodigious. He never gave up running the newspaper. And so he would have the paper read to him, and read to him visually, what the reader would say, you know, in a 72-point headline, flush right, this, photograph to the left, text here.
Uh-huh.
And Pulitzer would generate reams of telegraphs, but they couldn't be just sent as telegraphs because people can read telegraphs. You know, if you're J.P. Morgan and you're in London, you send a telegraph back to the U.S. saying to buy a particular stock.
People could get the...
Exactly. By the time your telegram gets there, that stock has gone in value. So everybody used codes, and Pulitzer was obsessive about this. He created a 5,000-entry code book in order to communicate with his newspaper. So every day when editors would arrive at work at the New York World, on their desk would be 5 or 6 coded telegraphs from Pulitzer. They'd get out their code books and translate them and know what their instructions were.
And was he less of a champion of the common man as he got older?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. You know, there's a Churchill statement once that said something along the lines of, if you're not liberal when you're young, you have no heart, and if you're not conservative when you're old, you have no brain. Well, Pulitzer in some ways embodies that. I'm not saying it's the right way to go, but in the case of Pulitzer, he retracts or draws back from a lot of his sort of radical positions as when he was a young publisher. And generally speaking, the rule of thumb is it involves wealth. He remains progressive on most issues. He's very strong in favor of peace, believes in certain kinds of taxes, and particularly political reform and ending of corruption. But when it comes to wealth, he begins to back away and begins to become protective of his own wealth in terms of his policies. So, yes, he does grow increasingly conservative as he ages.
Now, what about the Pulitzer Prize? Was that something that he wanted, or was it established in his name after he was gone?
No, it's very much his conception. When he ran the New York World, he gave prizes quite regularly to reporters. And we've talked a little bit about how in 1898, with the Spanish-American War and Hearst and Pulitzer being involved in this struggle, circulation war unmatched in American history, they both become tainted by this accusation of sensationalism. And Hearst is more guilty than Pulitzer, but they're entwined together forever in history this way. And I think part of Pulitzer's motivation in leaving his money for two major things, one, to create a professional school of journalism at Columbia University, and secondly, to create the prize, was in part to cleanse his legacy for future generations so he'd be remembered for that. But also he had a very strong belief in, at the end of his life, he didn't have this at the beginning of his life, in professionalization of journalism, and also a belief in something that I think people or listeners will find kind of corny today because of our sort of changing ethos and our cynicism. But he believed that journalism was a public service, that it was an essential ingredient in democracy. In fact, as you know, it's the only business in the United States that's explicitly constitutionally protected by the First Amendment. And so the most important prize from his perspective that he left was the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service.
Well, perhaps this book will win the Pulitzer Prize. That would be justice, eh?
Well, of course, any author hopes that, but, you know, the odds of winning anything, is a Pulitzer Prize is similar to winning the lottery. And I content myself mostly in the journey. I mean, it's been a wonderful 5 years, waking up every day, thinking and pondering about him. And really, most authors, I think, it's the work that keeps us going, not what happens afterwards.
Well, so what will you do next for the next 5 years?
I'm hoping to write a biography of Emma Goldman, the anarchist from the 19th century.
Oh, perfect. Well, this book is called Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print, and Power, and the author is James McGrath Morris. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It was an immense pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back again next week for another one. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at KUSP.org, find us on Facebook or iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank our guest, James McGrath Morris, the author of Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print, and Power. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.